Before statehood, Iowa's fertile and free land drew people from all over the world. Iowa's towns tell their stories. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In the next hour, we will explore the history of Iowa's towns. The settlers that came to the state created our communities. Sometimes towns were designed to remind settlers of their homelands. Often they were influenced by the landscape or the railroad. Sometimes they were the inspiration of one person, and sometimes they were the work of many. My guests today are Paul Lasley, he's the chair of the Sociology Department at Iowa State University, and Lauren Horton, historian emeritus of the State Historical Society. We'll talk about the people and places that shaped our state and how our communities continue to change today. Please join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. During the next hour, we are going to explore the history and design of Iowa's towns, and we're also going to talk about how our communities continue to change. My guests today are Paul Lasley. He's a professor of sociology and the chair of the sociology department at Iowa State University, and Lauren Horton, historian emeritus of the State Historical Society. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Hey, Paul, I want to start with you today. Okay. And let's go back to before Iowa became a state, when we had all of this fertile land and people from all over the world were attracted to the idea of coming and starting over here. Where were people coming from?
Well, you know, there was a real need to fill up the interior of the country. If we look back to American Revolutionary War, and this section of the country was purchased in 1801, the famous Louisiana Purchase under Thomas Jefferson. The first question was how to fill up the interior of the country to extend this American society, civilization westward, and much of that occurred early along the major transportation corridors, which were the rivers and streams. So that was the early migration, the Mississippi and Missouri River were the primary routes. People from the east, land speculators on the eastern side of the country, moved westward. But also many immigrants from Europe. Europe at the time was overpopulated. People were thirsting for land. My good friend Willard Cochran talks about land was the magnet that attracted people westward, but also attracted large droves of immigrants. It's estimated that in 1850, that half of the adult males in the United States were foreign-born. Huge waves of immigrants. And it was a little bit later with the development of railroads that contributed significantly. The railroads were given land that they could sell, given public lands in the territories. They could sell that land to speculators and farmers. The proceeds of those sales then built the railroads. And it was really the development of the railroads that opened up the interior of the country that really replaced the unreliable water transportation and was much faster and easier than the covered wagons, the overland trails that existed earlier.
Paul, as these people came to Iowa and found their homesteads and settled here and the interior began to fill up, I think a lot of us come from towns where we say we come from a German town or a Norwegian town. How did people of different ethnicities group together?
Well, you know, many of them actually migrated together. Many of them lacked the resources to finance themselves individually, and so they moved. Even in the case of overland, what we call the wagon trains, oftentimes were extended families and people that knew each other in the old country, and they would settle. Life in the frontier was challenging, difficult, and so one did not move out there on their own. They moved generally in groups for protection. You know, the early military, while it had established forts and outposts, actually for protection, but there was a lot of work that required group effort, clearing roads to move wagon trains, erecting cabins, and building fences and clearing land.
And, of course, starting to build communities as
That's
well.
Right.
And Lauren Horton, you have something you want to add to this.
Well, I did want to add that as groups came from Europe, they tended to congregate where they had neighbors that had similar religion, belonged to the same church, and also spoke the same language. So there was two methodologies of clustering, either a religious motive or a language motive.
And, of course, as these people came together, when there were enough people, a town seemed in order. So, Lauren, when people started to found these communities, did they spring up because there were enough houses close together, or did people plan them?
Both. You have to think, now, why did they want a town in this place? Is there a particular economic need for a town in this place? Along the Mississippi River, where the earliest towns in Iowa were, yes, because there was shipping up and down the river of products of both manufactured and raw materials. They needed places to load the barges, load the steamships, as it would have been at that time. Once you have the railroad wanted a loading station about every 8 or 10 miles as they went across the state. And as Paul has mentioned, the railroads got free land in 1856. They got alternating sections across the state, beginning in Dubuque, in Clinton, in Davenport, and Burlington, four lines going across the state. And that's a lot of land. And then they had to dispose of that, populate it, and then they needed the loading stations. So they plopped down towns along the way. In 1967, 1968, and 1969, there were hundreds and hundreds of centennials of towns in Iowa, and they were all railroad towns.
So the railroad influenced where towns would be, and Paul, also the grid. The grid here in Iowa influenced where towns would be. When did the grid come about?
Well, actually, the grid system of land measurement and disposal was created much earlier, and when this was still in Iowa territory, it was surveyed on the township and section lines using standard measurement. And of course, we see that grid system is still, Iowa probably is the best example of the grid system because mm-hmm. of the large expanse of prairie. Where you get in an airplane today, you can see the 640-acre sections laid out, 36 sections to a township. But, of course, in those days, most family farmers didn't need a section of land, and they actually needed quite a lot less than that. So, as Dr. Horton mentioned, the railroads got alternating sections, and that was alternating 640 acres. But then they would sell that land to frequently in parcels as small as 40 acres. But it was common that some would buy a quarter section, maybe perhaps a few. You know, the technology really limited farmers to relatively small tracts of land. So mm-hmm. so the land companies, oftentimes the railroad land companies, would then come in and survey and subdivide sections that the settlers could acquire. Now, some settlers, some of the early settlers, were able to get land under the Homestead Act, although by the time the Homestead Act of 1862 came about, much of the land in Iowa had already been taken up. But that was also an important policy of encouraging filling up the interior, making land available under the probably the most liberal land disposal act of federal government, 1862.
So this drives the location of settlers and the location of towns. Lauren, what does it take to have a town? What do you need to start a town?
If you're going to legally be a town, you have to survey a plat and record that plat in the county courthouse. But you have to have a purpose, a need for the town. Sometimes it's simply that a farmer wants to make money, and he may lay out a plat on his farm and then try to sell the lots. My own great-grandfather is an example of that. He laid out a plat on his farm in Indiana and never sold one lot. Failed utterly. But they tried that, and sometimes that succeeded beautifully. Sometimes you are too far away from an outlet for manufactured goods, and so you start a town and you have a general store. Sometimes you have products that you want to process, and so you plat a town, and then it's for meat packing, it's for lead mining, it's for this, for that. So generally, they started out as either suppliers of the surrounding countryside or processors of the products of the surrounding countryside.
Yeah, and Dr. Horton mentions the importance of religion, and certainly there are two issues. That one was, if you had a community of the same faith, the same immigrant community, that would select a site, one of the first things they'd do was to find a house of worship. Now, sometimes that would be a use of a public building. In fact, here in Ames, Iowa, the first congregation in Ames, Iowa, was the Congregational Church, which met in the first few years of being organized in the railroad depot. And some of the prominent families in Ames were Congregationalists. But that was true across the state. But the issue of transportation routes, I think one of the things even preceding the railroads were stagecoach routes, and sometimes where the horses would need to take a break, you'd see a hotel or a boarding room, so that the passengers would spend the night while the horses rested. So a hotel might give rise then to a restaurant or a place that people could eat. That might then stimulate a tavern, a livery stable, and you'd have the beginnings of a town. And then certainly the schools began to play a role.
Well, and we will talk more about town design and how our towns grew in just a moment. I'm talking with Paul Lasley, a professor of sociology at Iowa State University, and Lauren Horton, historian emeritus of the State Historical Society. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
My hometown.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today are Lauren Horton. He's historian emeritus of the State Historical Society, and Paul Lasley, who is chair of the Department of Sociology at Iowa State University. And we're talking about Iowa towns, how they developed, how they changed through the years, and how they continue to change as well. And right now we're talking about the founding of towns and town design. If you have any questions for our guests, or if you have some stories you'd like to share about your town, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to talk about the influence of water. We've talked about the grid system. We've talked about the railroads. But, Lauren, don't all towns need a source of water?
Absolutely. There are two things that towns need, regardless of their size. And one of them is a water supply, because people have to have water to drink. They can maybe bring food in from outside, but they have to have a local water supply. Incidentally, the other thing that they need is a graveyard, because if there's any population in the town for any period of time, somebody's going to die and they need to have a place to bury them. Sometimes when a town grows up along a river or a smaller stream, they can use that for the drinking water supply, but it is also used for commercial purposes in whatever manufacturing or businesses they have. And it's also, in the early days, the sewer for the town. So pretty soon, if you're using it for both drinking water and sewer, this is not good.
Or
so
if a town downstream was using it for drinking water.
Or the town downstream is using it. So you have to have a different public water supply. So those two necessities are sometimes overlooked when towns start, but they rapidly realize they need those two factors.
Well, we've talked about people coming to Iowa from all over the world. Paul, when we look at Iowa towns, especially some of the earliest Iowa towns, do they reflect the ethnicity of the people who settled there?
Well, they do, although we have lost a lot of that over time. But we still see a substantial number of communities that hold up their ethnic heritage with pride and celebration. And so, you know, there's a number of them that are quite famous because they work hard at maintaining a tradition.
Pella springs to mind.
Right. The Dutch communities, Orange City, Pella, the Danish communities, for example, like Elkhorn, where they brought a windmill in from the Netherlands a few years ago. Certainly the Czech communities is Cedar Rapids. Other communities that would include German days, where although the German communities have had a sort of checkered past, actually the community that I grew up in, Missouri, I remember my grandmother talking about during World War II, the shame that their community felt.
Yes, my grandfather stopped going by Detlef and started just going by D. So
right.
My great grandfather.
Yes. And we see that in case of Norwegian communities, Scandinavian communities, where it's probably less so because of the ease of transportation and intermarrying. But we still see a lot of pride around those ethnic communities. And I wanted to come back. You know, Professor Horton mentioned water. You know, the water was important not only for drinking, but also was a source of power. Yep. In those early communities. You would have a grist mill or manufacturing would use water wheels turn machinery. The other thing that has not been studied so much, but I know was important, was access to wood, which was really a problem out here in the prairie where there wasn't a lot of standing timber. People needed wood to build homes and barns and structures, but they also needed a source of firewood. You know, because that's what they needed. I think that resonates with Professor Horton.
Yes.
I believe I heard you agreeing there.
Yes.
Firewood was important. And so in some way, you know, the settlement of northern Iowa was lagged behind the rest of the state. For one reason was there was too much water. It was swampy. It was only until we figured out how to drain those wetlands that became prime agricultural land. But the other thing was that there wasn't any timber. So you had to find a source of wood, not only for a sawmill to make boards to build structures, but also they needed a source of wood to keep warm.
And we have a couple of questions from our listeners right now. This is an email from Gordy, and he wants to bring up the Native American presence in the state. He said it was not bought from the Native people who called Iowa home. It never fails to surprise me how you gloss over the facts, the people who lived here and who were displaced. The state was not formed in a vacuum. At least give credit where credit is due. And Gordy, I have to say, I think that's a different show, but something we definitely should talk about. And Tony also... Tony called to bring up the same fact, and he wants to, but he just hung up. So, but let's talk about how the Native American presence, the American Indian presence in the state of Iowa, influenced the settlement of the state. Paul?
Well, certainly, and I didn't mean to gloss over the heritage of Native Americans. Probably the greatest sins of our country was, in fact, denying the rights of Native people. So it was either bought, stolen, or negotiated away. Certainly some of the most incredible abuses of human rights were how Native Americans were treated. The date escapes me, but I think it was in 1857 that all Native tribes east of the Mississippi were rounded up and moved to Oklahoma.
1830, Act of Andrew Jackson.
That's right. Thank you. That 37 with Andrew Jackson and the displacement. In Iowa, there were about three or four treaties in which Native people were, the land was negotiated or exchanged. Professor Horton, you likely have those dates there in front of you. The one that I oftentimes hold up to my students, of course, is the Meskwaki settlement, which is a blend between the Fox and the Sac Indians in Tama County. That tribe actually was displaced to Kansas, and they came back and acquired land and bought land, so it's not a reservation. And it was their ties to their native land in the Iowa River. That represents.
So that does give a brief history. And again, I think this is a subject for another day and another show entirely. But what happened, and tragedy that it was Iowa, when all of these settlers came, was pretty much cleared. Before they came in or as they came in.
There's very few connections between the actual building of a town because the Native Americans were almost invariably gone by that time.
Well, let's talk about these towns as they were created, because, of course, today we have lots of titles about urban planners and community design and that kind of thing. But back then, there were no such things. So, Lauren, who designed these towns?
A surveyor would have laid them out, and they would have been given instructions on how many lots were to be laid out, in what pattern, and how large the lots would be. They might be 30 feet wide and 120 feet long or whatever. They laid them out, and sometimes they had a problem. My doctoral dissertation was on town planning in the Mississippi River, and I discovered a very interesting thing about, and I don't want to cast aspersions on the town of Davenport, but the original surveyor of Davenport was, shall we say, not at his best when he did the first survey, and they had to resurvey twice after that because he made errors in that. But nonetheless, they had to survey it, they had to draw a plat, and they had to record it.
So as these towns were designed, you know, if it's an individual who mm-hmm. lays them out, obviously that person has a great deal of influence over how they were laid out. What were some of the common designs?
The three most common designs were the grid, which looks like a checkerboard. It's absolutely square, streets running just like the crosses on a checkerboard. Rectilinear, which is simply two checkerboards side by side longer than it is wide, and curvilinear. Now, most of the towns in Iowa would fit into the grid or the rectilinear, but sometimes a town might be started that way. I'll go back to Davenport. Davenport was a grid. But as additions were made by Antoine LeClaire and John Burroughs, they sometimes had streets that followed the course of the river or the course of a ridge or the course of Duck Creek or whatever. So they began to deviate, not in the original design, but in almost immediately in the additions that were made.
It seems amazing to me that in the original design, the landscape wouldn't have been taken into consideration.
It has always amazed me, and I'll use two examples there. In Dubuque, for instance, you would think, well, it was started because of the lead mines, but you would think that they would build a town on the Mississippi River. No, they built it about a half a mile from the river, and there were several schemes to divert the river and bring it to the town. They all failed, so they filled in the marshland between the town and the river, and that's now buildable. The other one is Council Bluffs. Council Bluffs is built at the foot of the Luss Hills, which is more than a half a mile, I'm going to say a mile from the Missouri River. Some justification there because the Missouri River changes course pretty frequently. But nonetheless, sometimes in hindsight, it looks like they built it in the wrong place. To them, it wasn't the wrong place, but they had to make compensations because of where they put it.
Well, it seems that a lot of towns really strived to have a grid, really wanted to fit it into that standard checkerboard. And
they did.
I grew up in Cedar Falls, Iowa, and Waterloo, of course, is right next door, and the river goes right through Waterloo. And if you drive around town, you'll get lost if you don't know where you're going, because things say that they're east, and they're not east, they're not west. I've never understood why they're labeled
that
way.
The Cedar River does not follow the cardinal compass points, and so they had to plop a grid down as best they could to front on the river, and that makes it diagonal sometimes to cardinal compass points.
Paul, as these towns developed, we've talked about the railroads, but what about county seats and where those were designated? How did that influence development?
Well, part of what some of the confusion is that the transportation system, whether it was water or railroad or overland, began to really. So the railroads wanted loading stations every 6 to 8 miles. That also coincides with about how far you could ride a horse or take a team of horses if you were delivering grain to an elevator or driving cattle to a railhead. So about every 5 to 7 miles, you would find another community. And so one of the real challenges was to determine where the county seat would be. Now, it tends to be pretty much in the center part of the county. There are some deviations from that, but that tends to be what they attempted to do. It was also the county seat town then that became the hub of local government, and we see Iowa with its 99 counties with the courthouses, which became really a competitive who could build the most elegant, ornate courthouse. And we have some marvelous examples of early architecture in the settlement period of those courthouses. We had the same problem, of course, in where we were going to have the capital city built. Iowa City was the first capital. Des Moines was the second. I was as listening to Lauren talk about that the settlement. You know, maybe we should mention that currently Iowa still has about 950 towns, but that doesn't count all the what I call ghost towns or towns that one time existed but no longer exist and sort of remnants of towns. There's well over a if we were to include those, there would be well over 1,000, maybe 1,200 communities. So we've probably lost 200 or 300, either towns that failed to thrive or withered away. In the southern part of the state, we see a number of abandoned communities associated with coal mining. A group here several years ago at Iowa State University studied Buxton, Iowa, which was an African American coal mining community north of Albion. Nothing exists there, but our archaeologists went down and documented the history in a town called Buxton, which no longer exists. And there are a number of these what I call ghost towns. So we're really talking about an important area, an important era of settlement. Some of them thrived, some of them died. Some of that still continues today.
And sometimes a town died because the railroad wanted to get a bonus for going through that town, and the town didn't give them a bonus, and the railroad moved a mile or two outside of that town, and the town died. Yep. A good example of that, right close here to Iowa City, is the town of Wellman. It used to be a town of Wassenville that was north, and then the railroad decided to go through, go to miss it. And so Wellman was built. Wassenville, in fact, moved to Wellman, I guess you would say.
Well, we will talk more about the development of towns in Iowa and the whims of certain individuals or corporations that created or destroyed some of those towns. I also want to talk about the role or lack of a role of public land in our communities and how our towns continue to change. My guests today are Lauren Horton, he's historian emeritus of the State Historical Society, and Paul Lasley, who's a professor of sociology at Iowa State University. You're welcome to join our conversation if you'd like to talk about your town. Maybe your great-grandfather platted out that community. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about Iowa's towns, their history, how they developed, and how they continue to change. With me are Paul Lasley. He's the professor and department chair of sociology, not the only professor of sociology, but the department chair of sociology at Iowa State University, and Lauren Horton, historian emeritus of the State Historical Society. And I want to talk about public land in towns. Lauren, as these towns were laid out, and I know that we have a great lack of public land in Iowa, so as these towns were laid out, was public land taken into consideration?
Sometimes, but not often enough. Sometimes if it's a perfect grid town, they did leave a space right in the middle, which would replicate the New England town common or town green. But most of the time, those were later alienated or built upon. I want to compliment the city of Davenport, because when it was first platted in 1836, they left 3 square blocks as public land. Not parks, because that was not a concept yet, but as public space, probably for markets and that sort of thing. And I haven't been to Davenport the last couple of years. The last time I was there, those 3 square blocks are still used for public purposes. One's the YMCA, but it's still a public purpose. So most towns did not, but some towns did.
Well, that's really interesting because, of course, a lot of the towns that these people were coming from, European towns, most of them had village greens or this common space. Paul, do we know why that concept didn't pass?
Well, the proprietors of towns had the idea, so I've come to the conclusion that if there was vacant space, that was wasted space because you could sell it and make money. And so even if they set aside public space, very often they succumbed to selling it to make money.
I think that's right. And, you know, and we had such an abundance of land and such few people that the issue of green spaces or open spaces was not a concept. The whole country was open. It's sort of interesting. It's only when population growth occurs that we then start being concerned about space and public use areas. And I think that's maybe why Davenport stands out. The early founders felt there was a need to at least reserve some public space for perhaps the future. And, of course, that was an important trade center. So it experienced enormous population growth from its settlement through the Civil War period.
Terry is on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hello, Terry.
Hi.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, not public land, but I've been enjoying the conversation. My husband's family settled near Dunkerton, and they were one of the first families in Blackhawk County, but they had a small township called Lester Township that is no longer there, but the railroad went through Dunkerton, and so Lester was one of those towns that didn't quite make it. But my husband's family came from New York in the late 1850s, early 1600s, and he has diaries from those era that go through like 1902. The originals are in the Grout Museum, but my husband transcribed them all, and
Good for him.
So Iowa history is really fascinating. So we had the, and my husband's great whatever. He got the land in Iowa from a war of 1812, I believe, service. And
military script. They would call those military scripts. Rather than getting paid, you'd get land in exchange for service.
Well, he had eight kids, and New York and Connecticut was getting very crowded, and they all moved out in a big group to Iowa, and so the whole migration patterns, and so I've learned a lot from my husband when he's tracking his family history about Iowa history, for sure. And
so as they moved westward, a whole group moved together. How many years did it take them to migrate from Connecticut to Iowa? Do you have a sense of that?
Quite a long time, because I know that they, my husband's great-great-grandfather, I don't know how many greats, but he traveled the length of the Wapsie looking for a place to settle, and this was in the 1850s.
Right.
And by the early 1860s, I mean, I think they had stopped in Illinois for maybe a few years.
Yes, that's...
Part of that process.
Yes.
And while they were... Some of the guys were out, you know, scouting land and building cabins and, you know, getting it set up so everybody could join them. And
that's really fascinating, and that points out something that oftentimes is overlooked. The migration wasn't that you loaded up in Connecticut or Virginia on the east and moved west in a single season. That oftentimes it would take 6 or 8 years. And for people that study genealogy, one of the fascinating things is you can look back and see where children were born. Almost every year there would be a new baby born, and sometimes you'd find, I worked on my own ancestry coming from Virginia, so there were some children born in Virginia, some in Kentucky, some in Indiana, some in Illinois, till they finally got to Missouri. And that represented different years. And so that's why I asked the question of your family.
Well, and of course, not every settlement was successful. So there were some tries and some failures as they moved around as well.
Yes, yes.
And sometimes they wanted to come to Iowa, and sometimes they wanted to go further west, particularly to Oregon or to California, even in the middle of the 19th century.
That's right.
Well, Terry, thank you so much for your call and for sharing your story. And I want to bring up something that We've talked about the railroads making or breaking a town, but as things have developed, the interstate highways have also had that impact on small towns and continue to have that impact on small towns. Lauren, how have we seen that play out in our small communities?
Once you had a national highway system of hard-surfaced roads, towns tended to want those highways to go right through the main street because they would attract the business of the travelers.
So you look at the Lincoln Highway.
Exactly. But then it got to be the idea that you wanted to have the highway bypass, and a whole different business section grew up along that. The interstates mostly miss the small towns. I can't think of any small towns that the interstate does go right through. But it's a different concept of commerce. No longer are the travelers going to stop at every small town and buy something. They're going to go to the franchise chain places in larger cities now.
And we've all seen a lot of very sad downtowns and small towns that we love.
I think in some ways, Lauren, your point is that the highway interchange, the intersections, become the function of small communities.
They can do that,
so,
yes.
You know, so you get the mm-hmm. restaurant and the hotel at the interchange, and the small town might be, you know, is sort of bypassed. And so the function of the small town is replaced by these intersections.
Well, the complexes of motels, restaurants, gas stations, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's sort of the ribbon and cluster element where, like between Iowa City and Cedar Rapids, you have the corridor growth.
Yes.
And many, many towns have long, drawn-out business sections that are functions that would have been unknown 100, 150 years ago.
Yes. And Ben is on the line from one of those interstate highways from I-80 right now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Charity.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I wanted to see if there was a similar experience in Iowa. My forebears came into Kansas from England, and they had responded to a poster portraying the town of Clay Center as having a river and a steamboat and this very sort of elaborate setup. They got there and was basically a creek that they put a small boat on. And so obviously someone was, you know, really taking advantage or scamming, you know. And were there any instances of that kind of thing where people were portraying Iowa as something that maybe it wasn't quite?
Paul, you want to take that one first and then Lauren?
That's certainly a very common story because these were land. The land was oftentimes sold by the railroads to speculators, and speculators needed buyers, and so there became a whole industry associated with the brochures and pamphlets that were scattered throughout Europe, bragging about, you know, the amenities, the potential growth, the get rich schemes. And a lot of people were attracted to that, and that became particularly a problem in the western states, where the arid land and a hostile environment. You know, local people said that land is worthless, but with the right ad agency, you could get people from Europe that would spend money to get here. To find that they actually had acquired a piece of land that was desert.
It was very common for speculators and developers to have plats drawn and around the four edges of the plat to have pictures of drawings of buildings that didn't exist, but they pretended to exist. They would take those plats even to the eastern part of the United States and sell lots in this town that did not even exist at all.
Let's talk about another pressure that, of course, has influenced small towns through history and continues to influence our communities today, and that is weather. Mother Nature. Lauren?
Natural disasters have played havoc with town designs, as Cedar Rapids and Iowa City and many other towns know. From the floods of 2008, and I'm sure that ordinances are going to be changed or have been changed in both of those cities because of that flood. Fires and tornadoes also do that. There was, of course, the famous fire in the early 1930s in Spencer, the fireworks fire, but that influenced not necessarily the town design, but the way the buildings were built and what they were built of, with mm-hmm. firewalls mm-hmm. and made out of brick and not wood and so on. And then, of mm-hmm. course, the tornadoes have destroyed places like Pomeroy and made a havoc out of Grinnell at one time and Comanche, with lots of deaths, lots of destructions. And a more recent one would be Parkersburg. Mm-hmm. So they're rebuilding, but they're rebuilding differently than they did before this natural disaster.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Before we run out of time, Paul, I want to touch on something that, again, I think we could spend another whole hour on, and that is, of course, before statehood, there was this large influx of immigration. Now, we're also experiencing a large influx of immigration that's changing our communities. How is that influencing Iowa?
Well, I'm glad you raised that. You know, as I've reflected on Iowa's welcoming attitude in the early days of settlement, we had lots of diversity, people of different languages, different cultures, different traditions, from from the Amana colonies, where, you know, the they're close to Iowa City, German Piast. I think they were called the Ebenezer Society or the Community of True Inspiration, to the Icarian communities, Icaria community in Corning, Iowa, the Amish communities, the ethnic communities of Western Europeans, where the and as I reflect on this as being such a diverse, thriving region, welcoming people of different religions, different traditions, and then I reflect on what has occurred more recently with the influx of persons of Latino extractions. And I sometimes think that we have lost our sense of how important it is that we welcome newcomers to our shores. And you know, we've got, I think Governor Ray led the charge in the 1970s to resettle immigrants from Southeast Asia. And so we've got the Laotian communities and Hmong communities. And sometimes I think we fail to realize how important the diversity is and how that provides opportunities. And many of the folks that come to Iowa today are very similar to our ancestors that came to Iowa or to the Midwest, looking for opportunities.
And providing new life for some of our small towns as well.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that the immigrants' communities in the 20th and 21st centuries have changed town design very much, but they've certainly changed some of the architecture and the whole commercial elements of towns.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, gentlemen, we are out of time, but thank you so much for being here today.
Well, we could have gone on for another hour.
Oh,
Charity.
I think we need another.
Don't you think, Lauren?
I think 2 hours, don't you, Paul?
Yeah, you know, and it's right here ahead of the holidays, and I'm not very busy. How about you, Lauren?
I would have plenty of time for the rest of the day.
So, Charity, if you know, just
I'll get you both on the phone.
Just
invoke
a little of your executive privilege so we can continue this discussion.
It was a pleasure to be on the show with you, Paul.
Oh, I enjoyed it, Lauren.
Well, thank you both so much. I really enjoyed it. I'll have you back. How's that?
Okay.
Right. Thank you. That's a good offer.
Well, happy holidays to both of you.
And to you, Paul.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Paul Lasley is a professor of sociology, the chair of the sociology department at Iowa State University, and Lauren Horton is historian emeritus of the State Historical Society. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support and aims from Russell Mansky. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available all the time at iowapublicradio.org. And of course, you can send us email anytime you like. We'd love to hear about things you want to hear on the show or any feedback that you have. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about dancing in Iowa, dancing through the years, and a resurgence of interest in ballroom dancing today. And coming up at noon today on The Exchange with Ben Kiefer, we'll be discussing the top 10 Iowa news stories of 2010. That's as determined by the Iowa Public Radio staff. You can check out the list that we came up with on our Facebook page. Look for Iowa Public Radio, or you can find a link on Twitter at IPR Talk. And give us some feedback. Let us know what you think the top 10 stories of the year are, if you agree or disagree with that list. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. We'll be right back.